Welcome back. Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. The first hour just went whew, like we're in a time warp of some kind. It is actually probably measurable, though. But again, this actually goes back to the thing. You can sit there and you can think that time's passed by or things have happened that are impossible, but if you've got a recording device or something like that going, it doesn't work. Right, you know what I'm saying? Like that's this right. Last hour didn't feel like an hour, but yet the clock says it, and so does the recording. Kind of like Jodie Foster in the movie Contact, dropping through the little portal and being gone for 14 hours when anybody else only saw a second, and it was a recording device that made it real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true. There is a thing called the psi uncertainty principle, and basically, what that says is that. The system will let things happen that are non-objective, you know, in our causality. You beat the objective causality rat, but only if there's plausible deniability, a legal term, right? Only if there's plausible deniability. If there isn't any plausible deniability, then you're kind of discouraged, or the probability of those things happening, let's put it this way, starts to decrease. And why is that? Because if we all understood how this reality worked, we all realized that we could modify reality with our minds, then we would probably not like that. You know, it's sort of like that if you go to the coastal Africa, where there are people who will make you healthy or make you ill as long as you pay them, you know, money every week, you know, this sort of thing. It's very.
I thought they called that a metropolitan hospital.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, but there are those places where everybody understands that reality can be moved by mind, and often they're not very friendly places because we are people full of ego, full of fear, and we tend to want to bully or use whatever power we can to get what we want and keep it. And that's not a place. It's not a good idea to go there. So there is a kind of a, it's not really a part of the rule set, but it's more like company policy that you kind of discourage that sort of thing. So the plausible deniability is, that's
here's
just
another
the way
element.
It works.
The other element I want to inject here is this concept of fate or destiny. You know, you are meant to be here, you are meant to do this, or you're foredestined, or something of that nature. And you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of American Idol, okay? All these idiots come in there who can't freaking sing, who and the vast majority of them tell these judges who later on abuse them and tell them to frack off. It's my fate, it's my destiny to be here and to win American Idol. And I'm just like, dude, look, it's not your fate, it's not your destiny. And even the people who went there who do wind up winning to them, you could say it's fate, you could say it's destiny, but I found that those concepts actually only really work in retrospect. Only once you've got there can you say that it's fate or it's destiny. You can't say it beforehand, because then if it doesn't happen, then the whole concept gets thrown out the window.
Well, you have all these alternate decisions in your life, don't you? All the time we're making so many decisions, and effectively our life follows one course, and it could have followed so many others that you have to believe that I'm here now because of a series of decisions I made, but effectively I'm here now because of decisions my ancestors made as well. So the idea of does fate happen? Now, there is an interesting aside to this in that there has been experiments done in Germany where they've shown that the intention to do something is already your brain has already made a decision to do something up to 6 seconds before you do it. Now, effectively, this causes profound difficulties with the idea of, do I have freedom of action, or am I fated to do certain things in certain ways? Now, there was an English scientist called Marcus de Satoy that went to Germany to have a look at the guys that were doing these experiments, and he saw in his own brain when they did an MRI scan the way in which he was about to make a decision to grab something, which he thought he'd made completely arbitrarily, but his brain had already made the decision as to where he was going to go with his hand before he'd even thought about doing it. Now, this has profound implications, but only if we see time as being something in the future. Whereas, of course, as Tom will rightly say, you know, if you take... space is space. If there's nothing in space, there is no space. If there's nobody perceiving the flow of time, there is no flow of time. Everything is a subjective experience. And this is why we create our own reality in certain ways, if we can control the reality. It's like the way they discover subatomic particles. I was saying in the break that I think it was Richard Feynman or somebody that made the famous statement when they were actually trying to discover certain subatomic particles that they predicted would be there. They were there because they expected to find them there. And this is curious in itself. You know, they think there should be a subatomic particle at this point, and lo and behold, there is. So it's, again, evidence that we are in some way manipulating our own reality.
Yeah. Anthony, there is a reason for why people physically react before they, say, consciously react. Mm-hmm. And that's been known for a long time. Started with LeBay, I think, who did experiments.
Kornhuber. Yeah.
And then of course they use that data to say, well, then it has to be a deterministic reality because here we are going off to do it before we even know it. So obviously our consciousness is not leading, it's following. But that's not the case. The way the consciousness reality works is because it's virtual, because you get a data stream, okay, your data comes very quickly. Okay, now think of your playing with The Sims or World of Warcraft. What's that worst thing that always causes you problems? It's called video lag, right? Mm. Where you move your mouse to draw your sword and your character just stands there and doesn't move because it takes a long time before the signal gets into that server and moves your character. So it's video lag. And the same thing, the character does something and you don't see it until after it already happened, you know, some time ago. Video lag. Well, we have the same problem here. We've got this virtual reality, and there's one part of it that's really, really slow, and that's our bodies. Because our bodies work on this rule set, and it's mechanical, electrical, you know, tendons, pulling muscles, tensing across joints. You know, everything is very, very slow. It's a mechanical world there. So what do we do if we're consciousness to make this virtual reality work? We can't have things happening a few seconds after they're supposed to because we have this video lag. Well, we start the body going before, you know, things actually happen. In other words, everybody raise your arm when the bell rings, and you'll find that if you look at these tiny little potentials, arms start to raise. Now, they don't show any motion, but the process, the tiny little electromechanical processes going on in the muscle start to energize to raise the hand before the bell was ever rung. You see? Why is that? Otherwise, the bell would ring, and then we'd all sit around, and, a little bit later, we'd put our hands up. There'd be this video lag that's a problem. So the way the virtual reality is run is that it starts these slow mechanical electrical processes going early before they, you know, before they're really needed. Now, let's say the person changes their mind. They thought they were going to do this, and then they change their mind. Well, it starts process A, and then in the middle, it's got to change and start process B. And what does that do? It makes people who are not sure of themselves, who change their mind a lot, clumsy. All right, so take somebody and put them, 50 feet in the air on a 2x6. Let them walk across it. Now, anybody can walk across a 2x6 if it's laying on the ground. No problem. Put it 50 feet in the air, and most people will fall off before they get to the other end because they're hesitant. They're not steady. They don't know that they can do this. They're frightened. And what happens is these physical processes start, stop, change again, change. And it makes them really, really clumsy. Now, look at the athletes who are really good. What do they do? They'll tell you 80% of their game is mental. They have to see it. They have to have the whole process worked out in their head. And then their body just flows through it. You see? So that's how those things work. A good shot, whether it's an archer or a rifleman, they'll tell you that it's not as much a physical game. Everybody can point the gun and squeeze the trigger, as it is a mental game. You have to be really focused on what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. If you have that focus that's really steady, everything works smoothly. If you don't, everything works kind of jerkily. You see, it doesn't work very smoothly. So that's what they're measuring from LeBay all the way up to these things, you know. They're measuring these tiny little processes. When you say that they started to move before, you know, they got the signal to move, well, that's only in these micro processes going on inside muscle tissue is where the motion's starting. That's what they're measuring. They're not measuring that the arm started to actually move up before the bell rang. They're saying that the electrochemical processes start before the bell rang. The arm doesn't move till afterwards.
Couldn't we just put that into anticipation? Like they know the bell's going to ring, so their muscles tense up in preparation for it?
No, they actually see that it actually starts to move. In other words, there's certain electrochemical things. It's not just preparation. Preparation is one state, but then they actually see that, you know, electrical charges start transporting from, you know, one side to the other. You know, this is in preparation for the movement. It has to happen. If you're going to move, these processes have to happen. If you're not going to move, if you're just anticipating, they don't happen. But down at this micro level, the biochemistry starts functioning before, you know, the requirement to function, and it's just part of the system's ability. It's part of the system's way of eliminating video lag in this virtual reality.
There's a wonderful example of that, Tom. I don't know if you're aware of the Dean Radin and Dick Bierman experiments that took place. I think it was probably about 2004. And what they did was they took a group of individuals and placed them in a room with a projector. And the projector was going to be projecting a series of photographs, some of which were very relaxing, like kittens and sunsets. But interspersed in these photographs were really horrific images of car crashes and things. And what they did was they actually placed a sensor on the skin of these individuals, and the sensor could tell when the skin changed. It's something electrolysis of the skin or something. And you do that when you're worried or when you're frightened. And they found that consistently, that the person would know that the skin would react before the person had seen the image on the screen. And this was consistent. And they came to the conclusion this was because either they could anticipate, or your mind could know the contents of your immediate future, or it could be something a lot more simple than that, called a gambler's fallacy, which is the idea that if you're playing a game, say roulette, and it keeps coming up black, and every time it comes up black, the more times it comes up black, you'll believe the next time will be red. So if you see a lot of these individuals saw a series of pictures that were nice, every picture that they saw was nice, they know the next one is more likely to be a nasty one by statistics, and they'd react that way. But suffice to say, this again very much supports Tom's hypothesis there. So, you know, again, we have this idea of the rendering. And again, that is very, very persuasive to me. Yeah.
And it's not only that they were just showing these different kinds of pictures, but the picture themselves were randomly being selected by a computer. So the computer would go into a random number, and from that random number, it would generate, say, one of 300 pictures. So the people were actually starting to respond to the picture before the random number was chosen to select the picture. And I don't think it happened like most of the time, but with some people, it happened pretty, you know, it was almost a sure thing. They would always show the response when the ugly picture, you know, came up. So I don't think it's anticipation. I wouldn't think that it's the gambler's fallacy going on there, because that should miss almost as much as it hits. If you just anticipate and you say, well, I haven't had a bad one for a while, so it's about time, but you can fix that by making, equals numbers of bad ones, if you like, or something else. That's kind of, you can experimentally take, you know, get rid of that variable. But these people were starting to move even before the picture had been selected by the computer. And that's because the computer, it's a virtual computer, right?
It's a virtual
computer. The larger consciousness system knows what's coming next. That random number generator isn't really random. It's part of a series, part of a sequence. You pick a seed and then you get a sequence of random numbers. It's not like, you know, it's a truly random thing. Computers don't generally do truly random things. That's hard to create, true randomness. It's that's a lot more difficult. So it's just a it's a video lag problem that the system had to solve. Otherwise, it has this huge virtual reality going, and there's going to be video lag because you've got these real clunky human bodies following a rule set that requires, you know, levers and that kind of thing to make them go. You know, you got to squirt out a little hormone there, which sends a chemical signal someplace else, which has to travel through the blood and get to the brain and tell the brain to do something. And all of that takes a lot of time compared to the signals. Consciousness to consciousness is pretty well instantaneous. So it's a, you know, it's a simple problem that needed a solution.
Now, speaking of simple problems that need solutions, I remember I was having a conversation with Alan Abadesa Green. I don't know if you know of him, but he was talking about how, look, I was sitting down and I wanted to move a chair to the other side of my apartment, and I thought about it for a second. Now, I've got two choices here. Number one, I can get up and move the chair. Take me 2 seconds. Or two, I can go and be a monk for 60 years and learn how to move the chair with my mind. And it just gets to the point where you realize that just simply doing things the really simple, straightforward way seems to be the most effective, and you get the most accomplished. Do you believe in that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we're here for a reason, and that reason is to interact and, you know, and be here. We're not here to get out of here. That's not really what we're here for. You know, we're here to experience, to be, to interact, to make choices, exercise that free will, to evolve our consciousness. That's what we're here for. This is a consciousness evolution trainer. It's a virtual reality trainer that we're in. So that's what's going on. And the idea that, well, you're here, what you need to do is to get out of here. You know, so, you know, get in your mind to go take a trip, you know, spend all your time out of body or meditating or whatever. Then you're missing the whole point of being here. So yes, I agree with you. You know, that's not a good idea. You need to let that stuff go. It's good to understand. But look, this is life. This is what you're supposed to be doing, so pay attention. You know, it's that sort of thing. Go move the chair. You know, that's what you're supposed to do. Maybe you'll learn something.
Yeah. As Qui-Gon Jinn said to the young Jedi, don't draw upon your anxieties, Obi-Wan. Keep your concentration here and now where it belongs. But Master Yoda told me to be mindful of the future, but not at the expense of the moment. Be mindful of the living force, young Padawan. Yes, Master. We'll be right back after the break with Anthony Peak and Thomas Campbell at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man.
Welcome back.
I had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the show that goes everywhere, man, because, well, basically, I am a very flippant individual and very curious, like a kitten, and I'm sure, pretty sure it'll kill me like someday. But in the meantime, I get to enjoy lots of different, very interesting and, conversely, unpredictable things. And this is why I encourage people, if you're going to listen to this show, if you're listening to the show on a delayed broadcast at some day or some point, you know, on YouTube or whatever, understand something. If you listen to this show every day, and I don't want to sound arrogant here, you will learn quantitatively more than you can from any other viewing material, because it is so varied, so wide in its scope. And the quality of the guests that we have on this show is basically also quite varied. We go from the best of the best of the best to people you've never even heard of who are still very interesting anyway. So I'm going to encourage people, And this has been supported by many listeners to this show who have said to me they've learned more in 6 months listening to this show than they have in the last 15 years of their own personal research, listening to other people's shows and watching documentaries and things like that. It's because of that fact. Wake up. Keep listening to this show. You will learn something very valuable every day. Especially from my very special guest. In fact, this has been an awesome interview. Anthony Peak and Thomas Campbell. Now, you guys have websites, don't you?
Yes.
Plug them, because this show's kind of like a bathtub. Doesn't work very well without a plug.
Well, go ahead, Anthony. I'll do mine after yours.
There's no answer to that, Tom. Right, okay, my website is www.anthonypeake.com. That's Anthony with an H and Peak, P-E-A-K-E, similar spelling to my great-uncle Mervyn. I'm also on Facebook and very, very active on Facebook as well, so if you just look up Anthony Peak, you'll find me on here as well. In fact, I'm keeping an eye on what's happening on Facebook as we're doing it on this super-duper screen I've got.
Tom?
Okay. Yeah, I have a website that's www.mybigtoe.com. And also, you can go to YouTube. And if you go there, you just go for Tom Campbell or My Big Toe, or put in TWCJR44, and you'll get my YouTube site. And on my YouTube site, every time I go out and do a conference, a talk, answer questions or workshops, it all ends up on YouTube. Everything I do is put up on YouTube for free. And if you want to read my books but don't want to pay for them, you can go to Google Books, because they're there for free. Downside is you'll have to read them from a computer screen, but they're there just the same. Now, you can order books at my website, or you could order books at usual sources, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the other places in your neighborhood friendly bookstore. But one other, and that is www.mbtevents.com. And those are the people that run that site that basically organize my time, tell me, where to go and when to be there. It's always nice to have somebody to tell you where to go that's a friend of yours. So,
yeah.
So anyway, those are the sites if you want to know more about it. Just Google my name or Google My Big Toe. My Big Toe is the names of the trilogy I wrote, the book. So any one of those, and my sites will come up.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to shift gears here a little bit and talk about Philip K. Dick, one of my Facebook followers. Asked these guys about Philip K. Dick, and I said I don't think it's appropriate to be talking about his experience with that, but. If there is anything that's very interesting, because I've heard a number of things about this guy. Number one, he was really quite into his methamphetamine and was capable of producing numbers of full novels, like per year, just on the burns, getting it down, and just pumping out all this material. The man's a prolific author, and there was one incident that I thought was very interesting. He, in one of his books, he had a character that walked into a convenience store to buy some milk, and it turned out that the person at the convenience store there he's buying the milk off was like his cousin or something like that. And a couple of years later, Philip K. Dick walks into a convenience store, buys a bottle of milk, starts up a conversation with the guy behind the counter, and it turns out that man was his cousin. This is very interesting.
Philip K. Dick was an extremely fascinating guy, and I'm in the process of researching and writing my seventh book at the moment. And one of my UK publishers said, we'd like you to write a new biography of Philip K. Dick. And over the last 6 months, I've read virtually everything that's ever been written by him. I've read every single biography, every article. I've read all his letters and everything else. And I find him an absolutely intriguing character. It does seem that at times he was precognitive. That's quite clear. It seems that he had a series of profoundly deep and meaningful experiences in his life. He called it 2374, which happened in February and March of 1974, when he claimed that he had manifested within himself another element of himself. He also started to believe that time was orthogonal, as he called it, which effectively meant that there's a time that runs horizontal from this time, and he believed that we were all living within the Roman Empire still, and 70 AD. There were very many, many strange things that happened to him, and what I'm trying to discover is the background to these things, and I'm trying to do the neurology to try and find out if there are any neurological areas that we could actually understand exactly what happened to him, because his books are intriguing. You know, if anybody's read any Philip K. Dick books, you will find them to be the most wonderful, mind-blowing and mind-expanding experiences. And this is because he was writing from his own experiences. He wasn't writing necessarily fiction. He was embroidering his own experiences in a fictional way. And all his books after his experience in 74, books like Valis, The Divine Invasion, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, were all books based upon the things that happened to him and him trying to understand what happened to him. He's a fascinating guy, and I'm living his life at the moment. That's all I'm doing, is reading about Philip K. Dick and reading his letters. So sometimes I was at a Society of Authors meeting today, and I was trying to explain to the people that when you write a biography of somebody, you almost become them, because you start to think like them and everything. It's quite strange, quite strange experience.
Mm-hmm. Tom, have you had any experiences with him?
No, I have not. Don't have anything to add on that, although I've had plenty of precognitive experiences, the things you mentioned. Those are not rare. You know, a lot of people have precognitive experiences. That's just, again, the future is probabilistic. And some things in the future are very probable, even pretty far out, so that you can make good predictions. And other things can be nudged, if you will, by the system to occur, because it's just probability, and people modify it as they go. So, yeah, precognition is a pretty common experience in the population.
Well, we had a discussion yesterday about how sci-fi movies, comics, and things of that nature, and in fact have really predicted things, like the way things are going to go, or have maybe given inspiration for new inventions that are coming out, like the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek kind of thing, where they had the little hand communication devices that later on came true as cell phones, you know, that kind of thing. And I was wondering exactly what the bridge is between precognition, artistic inspiration, and manifesting it within reality.
Yeah, they're all related, obviously. I mean, sometimes it's just good guessing. You think, what would I really like? Sure would be neat if you just had a phone I could pull out of my pocket, you know, and talk to somebody. So you put that in your show because that just seems like a really good thing. And if it's something that's a really good thing, which means it's very marketable and people can make a lot of money, then it's got a pretty high probability, you know, of coming about if it's technically feasible, you know, if it actually can be done. So you have that, plus you have people get their inspiration often from this larger consciousness system. And you'll find that not only in the arts, not only the people who write and paint, that they kind of get in that state, which is sort of a meditation state, but, you know, eyes open, whatever. And once they're in that state is where their inspiration comes from. It doesn't come from their intellects. It comes more from their intuition. And scientists are the same way. You know, you read some of Albert Einstein's, biography, and a lot of his ideas came to him, you know, not because he beat them out of the mathematics with his intellect, but because he relaxed, opened up his mind, and it just dropped in, you know. So lots of stories. You know, you talk of movies. How about The Matrix? You know, lots of stories have kind of paved the way for our thinking about reality, because we do get this stuff out of the future probable database. We are connected to all these things. We just don't know that we are. It's not through our intellect. That's not where the connection is. So there is a tight connection with, you know, these things that happen, why they happen, how it is that art seems to imitate real life before real life, actually gets there. It's all very intertwined, entangled, as Anthony might say. You know, it's all connected in very interesting and generally very productive ways.
Well, it's intriguing, though, that you mentioned The Matrix, because the Wachowski brothers, who directed and wrote The Matrix, very much said that they were very much influenced by Philip K. Dick and Philip K. Dick's writings. And, of course, there's been so many movies based upon Philip K. Dick's work anyway, you know, from Total Recall.
Minority Report.
Again, and Blade Runner is the classic, which was based upon Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, or very loosely based upon that. But one of the things that intrigued me about Phil was... one of the most amazing precognitions he had is absolutely evidenced because it's from a dated letter. And in about 1975 or 76, I think, he wrote a letter to a pen pal called Claudia Bush, or Claudia Krenz Bush. And in the letter, and I've got an original, one of the copies of this letter, he says that a couple of nights ago, I had a very, very strong hypnagogic image. Now, hypnagogic imagery is that when you're in that kind of liminal, half asleep, half awake state, what Tom was talking about just before, about where creativity comes from. And while he was in this liminal state, he had an image of a man lying face down between a coffee table and a settee, or an armchair. And he said, I just had a terrible feeling about this image I saw. In 1982, in March of 1982, Phil hadn't turned up for a regular meeting he used to have with a group of friends of his, people like Tim Powers, etc. And he didn't turn up. So they sent somebody round to the house, and they couldn't get in. So the group got together, and they opened the door, and they found Phil lying flat face down between a settee and his coffee table. Now, that to me is amazing, because there we had an image of him seeing in a hypnagogic state his own death scenario, because although he wasn't dead at the time, he had a massive stroke, and he died about 4 or 5 days later. Now, that intrigued me, because that is absolutely a provable fact, because the letter is in existence and it's dated. Now, that's intriguing to me. And again, as Tom would say, perfectly explicable within my big toe.
Mm-hmm. And exactly how did you come up with the term my big toe? What is this to do with?
Well, TOE, of course, is a acronym in the physics community, stands for Theory of Everything. Einstein started that acronym. He was doing a thing called Unified Field Theory. The idea was that quantum mechanics and relativity, though both very successful, each one denied a fundamental premise of the other, you see. So scientists knew at the time there's something else. You know, these two are subsets of something bigger. So they went on this search for, you know, the theory of everything, which would be something that you could derive both quantum mechanics and relativity from, kind of the superset, if you will. And that's where it started. So it's called a toe, a theory of everything. Now, my big toe, I called it that because there's something that I tell everybody, and that is that if it's not your experience, it can't be your truth. So because this is mine, this is my big toe, I don't want you to believe it. That would be foolish. Belief is what gets people into trouble. Belief is a barrier that shuts you off. It makes you no longer open to new data. So by all means, I tell you, don't believe it. But I give you plenty of hints and instructions on how to go experience it, to make it your own truth. So it's my big toe. That's why.
All right. I get it. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, ladies and gentlemen. Anthony Peake from anthonypeake.com and Thomas Campbell from mybigtoe.com. Final segment right after the break, ladies and gentlemen.
Bonkers.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that is just a little bit bonkers. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I don't know. I feel free to be silly and break from conventions and break from rules. Rules are made to be broken, and so are arms and legs and various other things. And you know, the thing that really occurs to me is your life path and where you think you're going to be and who you think you're going to turn into is really a interesting road of broken dreams that you pick up the pieces and you create something new entirely. It's probably a lot better than how you originally envisioned yourself turning out. You know, you don't wind up being a fireman or an astronaut or something like that. You become somebody completely different from who you thought you were as a child, as your experience has kind of come on to you and sort of force you in a different direction, whether or not you like it. And I do believe that suffering, really, trauma, things of this nature, are the things that really shape you and break you and give you those little pieces that are smashed to build something much better. Anthony Peake and Thomas Campbell are my guests, and we were talking over the break about how, you know, we've only got 12 minutes left or something like that, and what the hell will we talk about, you know? We've got Anthony Peake and Thomas Campbell, jeepers creepers, what the heck can we put into this inside of around about 10 minutes? And they were like, well, Vinny, it's your show, you know, we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. And I go, no, it's my show, and I want you to talk about what you want to talk about.
So what I'd like to talk about, funnily enough, very quickly, is something I was talking about offline again, was the coincidence of Tom's concept of my big toe, in the sense that my concept of my own ideas, my own hypothesis, I also call big toe, which is quite strange, and mine is the Bohmian IMAX grand theory of everything, which I do not have time to go into detail here. But I find it quite curious that both of us, quite coincidentally, have come up with the same acronym. I can understand the toe side of things, but the big is very, very strange. And you wonder if, again, there was some kind of plan to get us together. And Vinny, here we are now, our whole lives have been drawn together as a series of coincidences and collapsing wave functions in order to get Tom and I talking to you this beautiful evening in February.
Well, in actual fact, it's not collapsing, it's collaboration, because Guillaume, Jacques, I think, I don't even know his name, he's French, and he's the one who organized this entire week of guests, and I want to give him a big ups, because we've had some really fantastic guests, and the week is not yet over. And he was on a call with me and our mutual contact, Alan Eberdesser-Green. I believe you've written a section for him on the Sync book, and I'm going to be interviewing yes. him or vice versa soon. And he wanted to help me because I've always, you know, doing lots and lots of stuff. And he wanted to help me by organizing a week full of guests. So it's just one thing leading to another, leading to another, leading to another. And what I find is if you're a good person, you know, like I believe that I am. I could be wrong. You know, maybe I'll have some kind of realization that I'm actually some kind of a-hole. But if you're a good person and you try to do good things for other people, yeah, good things happen.
Yeah,
there's no mystery.
Probably the case. Yeah,
that's the way it works. That's part of the way we make our own reality. You know, you create that. You create those good things happening. The synchronicity, you know, has a process to it. It's not just random. You create those sorts of things because of your attitudes, because of your intents. When you give, you get back. If what you're interested in is getting, then getting is very difficult. You know, the thing you said earlier about pain and misery, it's unfortunate, but it seems that pain is a much better teacher than feeling good. When we're feeling good, we just kind of kick back and everything's fine, and it's like, don't change anything because it's good now. But when we get that pain, you start looking for things to change, looking for ways to be different or do it different. So that's the unfortunate truth for us, is that we learn through pain, and we don't learn much if we don't have any pain.
Yeah, and this is why I was just thinking these last couple of days. You know how these people who work in an office building for like 30, 40 years or 50 years or something like that, and they retire, they get a cheap gold watch, and they run and they wonder what the hell they did with their life, and then they wind up going to university to become a doctor and study for 8 years while they're 65 years old or something like that, and by the time they get out, they get superannuation and they can't practice anyway. It's like, I just wasted my freaking life. You know why you wasted your life, mate? Because you were spending all your time worrying about making things secure in your life when there's no real such thing. And not to mention, the only reason why you're capable of working in that office environment for so freaking long without actually wanting to leave and actually really doing something about it is because there was only slight frustrations and slight irritations and things like that in your life. If your boss had been a complete psychopath or something like that, if your employees or if your fellow employees had ostracized you or treated you terribly or something like that, you would have gotten the heck out of there. You would have learned something. You would have changed something. You would have made your life better, but you didn't. And I think that's what we really need to recognize about how our life really works, is that if you really want something, don't wait for things to get really bad before you go about changing them or trying to figure them out or being curious about them. You know, constantly you've got to be learning, learning, learning. It's I forget who told it to me, but it's called being a perennial student. And I hold that belief to be really true, because the brain has such a capacity for learning things and figuring things out, problem solving and what have you, that you could literally be learning things from the first day of your life to the last day of your life, and you'd still know only a fraction of the knowledge that is out there.
Totally.
Don't waste your time.
I mean, I was very much intrigued, again, what Tom was saying before about creativity and the way in which we have this amazing capacity to learn new things. And I found, you know, as I've got older, that my brain should be slowing down now, and it doesn't seem to be. My brain seems to be more effective now than it was in my 20s and my 30s. And it's because I'm interested in what I'm doing, and because it drives me more than anything else, than ever anything in my life. I mean, I don't earn a great deal of money from my writing, but what I do find is now is that, to use the Abraham Maslow idea, I'm self-actualized. In fact, literally, to make a pun, I'm experiencing my own peak experience. And anybody knows that Maslow's hierarchy of needs will get that pun as well. But effectively, in my book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self, it's again one of the areas I look into is creativity and how, where this creativity comes from, where we get this information from. And why it is some people have a great need to understand and learn, and other people just don't seem to be interested. And I do find that amazing as to why people aren't open to the... Life is an experience to learn and to understand. Other people just want to vegetate, and I don't understand why. I don't find it very sad.
Maybe it's because you know the difference. And again, this goes back to the suffering, you know, and learning the lessons of it. Sorry, Thomas, go ahead.
That's all right. I was going to say, we have free will, and we are the sum of our choices. All the choices we've made are going to lead us to where we are today. But to not do anything is also a choice. So that is that's your free will to make that choice. Unfortunately, you know, we have two kind of truisms I'm sure we've all heard before, and one is that you don't really know what you don't know. You know, the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't really know a whole lot, you know, that there's so much more to learn. But the other side of that coin is the more that you learn, the easier it is to learn more. So it's an accelerating process. The more you learn, the easier it is to learn more, and then you learn more. So it's a snowball rolling downhill. So like Anthony says, it's not that you end up, in your 60s and you're brain dead, is that you end up in your 60s and that ball's still rolling. You know, you're still able to learn more quickly than, you know, if you have been learning all along. And if you've been sitting in an office, you know, watching, you know, your toenails grow or something, then you can't learn a whole lot later in life, because learning isn't part of what you do. You know, what you do is kind of sit around and get by. And for those people, you know, life is tedious. And
Tom, is that the my big toenail then?
Yes. The big toenail parable, and I think it's like if you use it or lose it sort of thing. Like if you don't use your muscles, they start to atrophy, and I think that the same is true of your brain. If you don't use it, it starts to get more and more pathetic. You know, you can gain its strength back if you really work out and try and stretch it and that kind of thing, just like a muscle, but. If you don't do it, if you don't get off the couch, you're still going to be fat and lazy and eating potato chips and not getting anywhere.
Yeah. See, there's this thing, I don't know if you remember from your high school science, a thing called Brownian motion. That's where a lot of particles bump into each other. So a bunch of particles in a jar, they all move randomly because they're all bumping into each other. Well, we have a thing sort of called, that I call social Brownian motion. We make these choices. But people will tell you, well, just nothing ever interesting happened to me. You know, I never had the kind of opportunities, you know, that other people had. Well, that's just not true. It's what you make of it. You're bumping into other people. Not only are you making choices and having to learn and grow or not based on those choices, but so are all the people around you. And you're all bumping into each other. And those bumps change you. Make a difference. You know, like you said, what you thought you wanted to be when you were six, the fireman or the policeman or the airplane pilot, most of the time doesn't work out. What job do you have? Well, it's not because you planned for it and went out and got it. Most of the time, it's because you happen to be at the right place at the right time with the right attitude and the right needs, and it just went together. So that's why you're a doctor or an Indian, you know, or, you know, whatever, a mechanic. Because that's where you were when that choice was needed to be made. So there's lots of opportunity, lots of randomness. The pot's always being stirred, and all we have to do is take advantage of it, make good choices.
That's right. And I think when you're taking advantage and you're making good choices, the thing that you'll notice is that from one day to the next, from one year to the next, you don't recognize the person you were. Because the change in yourself is so rapid in its evolution that you just kind of stop looking back and you start looking forward. Anthony Thomas, thank you very much for coming on the show today. It's been a very, very great pleasure and various other nice adjectives. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Vinny. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Assured.